Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, all. Charlie Hedges here. And on my show today is Leonard Perlmutter, philosopher and spiritual meditation instructor. Leonard's latest book is titled Your Conscience. It is a most insightful book about the four functions of the mind and how the conscience is the deciding mechanism for our ego, our unconscious, and our senses. In this philosophical yet also very practical discussion, Leonard, also known as Ram Dev, explains to me the power of the conscience to guide us to make the best choices we can in our lives. Leonard offers practical ideas about the mind that I have never even thought of. How fun it is to learn. Please enjoy and learn with me in this thoughtful discussion with Leonard Perlmutter. Leonard Perlmutter, welcome so much to the next chapter with Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. I appreciate being with you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to our time together. We had such a nice chat earlier in the week, and as happens so many times, I feel like I should record that chat and make that chat our podcast because I thought it was so good. So I'm looking forward
to... Can you do that? Do you have that skill set?
Can you go back in time? I may have the skill set, but I don't have the equipment. So that's going to be getting in the way. But you know, let me tell you, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a couple of months because you are a first on this show. Never before have we interviewed such an experienced and learned teacher of what I'm calling the practical applications of what you have, this unique combination of meditation, spirituality, and philosophy, and you've done such fine work on the integration of Eastern and Western thought that I just think you bring so much to the table that I can't wait to talk about.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, you deserve it. So let's jump right in. You know, we could play softball, but let's have the lights on and the first pitch. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to begin today's show to know just a little bit more about your personal history. It seems that you've invested your life in the implications as well as applications of spirituality and philosophy. Tell me, when did that begin? How did that journey begin for you?
Well, Charlie, it really began when I was a child. For whatever reason, I guess some people would say karma, but I've always been philosophically oriented. That's just the way that I've always looked at the world and looked at relationships. And not only has philosophy been important to me, even before I knew what philosophy was, but also I'm a very practical person. So I tell people that I've always had an allergic reaction to just studying esoterica and memorizing esoterica without an application that's practical. Now, if there's esoterica that I learn, something intellectual, and yet it has a practical application, that's for me. And I'd be happy to work with it. But otherwise, I really tell people I don't have a lot of time for that. So I guess I'm philosophically oriented since a little child, as well as practically oriented. And I think that we spoke about the fact that those two principles led me at a very early age to join the Cub Scouts and the Boy Scouts because they had a philosophy. Be prepared. That was the motto. And they had a practical application. They certainly did. And they taught life skills. And I really thoroughly enjoyed that. That was for me, that was more interesting than school because it had a practical application. And so as I got older and I began after my dad passed at an early age, I was looking for meaning and purpose in life. And I found Swami Rama, who later became my teacher. And I really never wanted or desired to meet him. He was an Indian Swami, but being an American, I sort of had an allergic reaction to giving my life over to somebody else. But the more I read his books, it seemed to me that this man was writing as if he were a scoutmaster. And that's the way he presented yoga science, the oldest science and philosophy of spirituality and meditation in the world. And so I was very attracted to that because of the practical application. And the more that I experimented myself, I felt better physically, mentally, emotionally, and even spiritually. And one day, about 13 years after I began studying his books...
And how old were you when you began studying his books?
Excuse me?
How old were you when you began studying his books?
Let's see. I was probably in my... I would say around 35.
Okay.
Around 35. Because I met him approximately the age of, I would say, 48.
I appreciate so much the integration of practicality and philosophy, and so many times Eastern thought and ancient Western spiritual thought are so filled with esoterica that you have a hard time applying it to everyday life and making sense of it without talking gobbledygook, without talking how does this land? And I too was a Boy Scout, and I very much appreciate the learning, and I think, as I told you, I certainly had my entree into leadership through the Boy Scouts. The Boy Scouts were, you know, taught me everything I needed to know to begin to being a leader. And I think that's what you do to the world of philosophy and spirituality. I think that's what you're trying to do. Would you agree?
Yes, but really, everything that I present is just simply a reflection of what I practice. So I really don't intend to do anything with the teaching other than share what I do. This has worked for me. I remember when I was in Scouts, when I was a young boy, and the motto was "Be prepared." I asked my scoutmaster at the time, "Be prepared for what?" His response was, "How would I know?" And of course, how would we know? So we have to be prepared. And the only way that we can be prepared is to have tools and skill sets so that we can be both mentally and physically flexible enough to deal with all that life has to offer. Because it is a thrill a minute, this marathon that we're running.
When we, you know, but I think that's a conscious choice to look at life that way, don't you? Because I don't think everybody would look at life as a thrill a minute.
Well, I only look at it as a thrill a minute now because I have a philosophy of life that provides me a confidence, a quiet confidence. And I have cultivated a certain sense of self-reliance, not necessarily a reliance on me personally, but on the divine perfect truth that comes through the conscience. So the more I dedicate myself to that, I have confidence not only to practice, but also to share what I practice, because I see the value of it. I know the value of it in my own life. And if it worked for me, it just seems logical it will work for others if they could give it the same kind of energy.
Do you see our spiritual life as being something that's a partnership with the divine? There are things that we learn from the divine, but we're responsible to act them out, to live them, to share them. Do you see sort of a cooperative there, or do you see them as two different things?
Well, no, it's definitely a cooperative. I always use the word service, because in every relationship, my primary goal is to serve the truth as best as I can understand it through my own conscience in thought, word, and deed.
You know,
so that partnership, from my perspective, is based on service to a wisdom that is vastly more truthful and more purposeful and more beneficial than anything that I could come up with.
Boy, we agree on so many things in our discussion before, and listeners know that I have a discussion with my guests before, and I continue to find we're in agreement, and the idea of service. I believe so much in service, and that we are created to serve, and that is when we are in most, I think, in agreement with you, that we are most in alignment with the divine when we are serving, because the divine is serving, and we are just reflecting what is like in the divine. You know what I want to get into?
Can I just share a short story?
Please do.
This is diverting a little bit, but it's a marvelous little story that underscores that point about service. There is a story about Mother Teresa, who visited Chicago when she was alive, and there were a group of business people who had dinner for her and had a conversation, and they announced that they were putting a large sum of money away in some type of financial instrument that they wanted her to know that she could draw on that whenever she needed it for whatever project she chose. And she thanked them very, very much for their love and the way that they thought about her. But she said, you know, right now I don't have a need for anything, and I would not want to take that money out of circulation. I simply want to be a pencil in the hand of Jesus. And if and when I needed the money, I'm certain that it will be there. So take that money and give it to somebody who needs it now. I was very impressed with that.
As am I. I just continue to be.
And I love the choice of the pencil.
Yeah.
Because that graphite is going to be used up.
I like pencil because I have used, believe it or not, I have used the concept of pens. Is that we are pens, like, you know, like a nerd, you know, with our pen. What do they call those that you put in your pocket that has all your pen holders? And God has one of those, and one of those has my name on it, and we'll pick up and use that pen at God's discretion. But I like the idea of pencil. I like the idea of graphite, that it is not that it can be used. It can be used up. It can be resharpened, but that you know one must be diligent in using it wisely.
And, that's right.
And that's what Mother Teresa showed us.
Yes.
What a great illustration. Thank you.
Yes.
You know, you have just written a book that's titled Your Conscience, The Key to Unlock Limitless Wisdom and Creativity and Solve All of Life's Challenges. I'm sorry. I want to talk about solving all of life's challenges, but before I do that, you have such a unique view of conscience. Now, in most of our understanding, conscience is almost a negative voice telling you, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, I have a bad conscience. My conscience is telling me not to do this. It's sort of an American mantra almost. But you have a completely different view of conscience. I mean, no. It's not completely different. It's just expanded from that, I would say. Maybe could you describe what you think of conscience? Because that will be a very primary part of our discussion today.
Well, of course, I think that most of us, even when we were children, had the intuitive belief that there are different voices in our mind. And as it turns out, that's true. There are different voices because there are different functions of the mind that operate the mind, that in turn animate the body. So we hear from medical science that we are mind, body, human beings. But we don't really understand what that means. But there is a direct correlation between mind and body. Without the mind, the body could not and would not move. It has to be activated by thought, by the mind. And that's very, very powerful. So the conscience in this process is critically important. Why? Because it is the only function of the mind, of the four functions, that can discriminate, determine, judge, and decide. What does that mean? Well, it's very profound. What it means is that every single decision that we have ever made or will ever make has been and will be always made by the conscience. The conscience is the only function of the mind which can decide for us what's to be done and what's not to be done, what's to be said and what's not to be said, what's to be thought and what's not to be thought. The other functions of the mind that I'm sure that we'll talk about in a little while, are only counselors. They can only suggest and advise, but they cannot make the ultimate decision. So the conscience operates just like a mirror. That's its functionality. It's a mirror. It's part of our mind. It's part of this mind-body-sense complex. It's inside the matrix, so to speak. But the conscience is what separates us from other kinds of animals. Only the human being has a conscience. And the conscience can reflect, it has this capacity, can reflect perfect wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind. Now, I never heard of the superconscious mind when I was in any level of schooling. But it turns out it's the same portion of the mind that Albert Einstein saw mathematical equations and Paul McCartney hears beautiful melodies. Doesn't mean that either of us is going to become a songwriter or a physicist. What it does mean is the more that each of us consciously uses and that we rely on the wisdom reflected, the superconscious wisdom reflected by the conscience, the more that we serve it in thought, word, and deed, we will be able to fulfill the purpose of our life without pain, without misery, and without bondage. Now, people that are listening, they have no idea whether what I'm saying is the truth or not. And that's okay. I myself am a doubting Thomas. So I ask people not to believe me, but if they're interested in anything that comes up tonight, I do endorse their experimenting with it. Turn their entire mind-body-sense complex into their own personal laboratory and experiment and find the truth for yourself. Only then will you know and know that you know. And that's the truth that really does set us free.
Wow. I want to come to experimenting, but I have a question just for clarity for me, and my guess is for some people that are listening, is that historically in my education and my understanding, conscience is limited, seems to be limited to ethical choices. What is good, bad, right, wrong?
No.
But you are not limiting. It doesn't disclude those, but it is so much more than that, is it not?
Well, what does Shakespeare say on that? He says, there is no such thing as good or bad. Only thinking makes it so. Mm-hmm. Only thinking makes it so. And I think that you and I discussed that story about the three umpires.
Yeah, yeah.
And the three umpires were having a dinner, discussing shop, talking about business, talking about what constitutes a ball and what constitutes a strike. And the first umpire, who is a rookie, says, I call him as I see him. The second umpire, who's been calling balls and strikes in the major leagues for 8 or 10 years, says, I call them as they are. And the third umpire, who's an old pro, calling balls and strikes for about 25 years, looks at the other two and says, they are what I call them.
I just love that illustration. That is so true that reality, we are the definers of reality in our life.
Well, we're not, but the concepts that are in our unconscious are. So we only perceive what we first conceive. And the problem that we have, the challenge that we have, is that so many of our unconscious concepts are faulty.
Because of education?
Where did we get these concepts from?
Yeah.
We got them from mom or dad or grandma or grandpa or our siblings or friends or celebrities or politicians.
Or education.
That's right. So we perceive what we conceive. And so many of our concepts are not accurate. You know, some of our faulty concepts are very harmful. Some are really sort of inconsequential, but nonetheless they're faulty. For example, here's a simple concept that we all have stored on our unconscious mind that's not the truth. And that is, the sun rises in the east and it sets in the west. And we teach that to our children. Of course, we know that the sun does not rise in the east, and we know that it does not set in the west, but we teach our kids.
We do.
That's the truth.
We do.
But it's an optical delusion, as Einstein might say. Right? That's all. The rising and the fall and the setting of the sun is all based on what? The rotation of the earth. There is no sunrise and there is no sunset. But that's an innocent concept that's inaccurate.
I think, you know, in literature they call it a synecdoche, where the part represents the whole. And
yes.
And so am I hearing what are you suggesting then that we have a very strong power of choice in what is what we're to do with what we know and what we learn. And the conscience will speak to us, and we can listen to it, we cannot listen to it. There is a sense of choice in there, is there not?
If there is a requisite desire, it's all about desire, Charlie. There first has to be a desire, the fuel for action. Without desire, nothing happens.
I once had a therapist who told me that human beings are essentially a ball of desire. That is what we are. We're born with. We're created with, and yeah, that is who we are. Is desire. And so could it be then that we at times we ignore that desire in light of some other construct or some other need or some other problem? And so we will ignore desire. Is that possible?
Well, there's a story about a man. He has a desire. He has a small desire to lose some weight. He's been gaining a lot of weight lately, and he knows that it's not good for him. Too much weight that is being carried by the body. But he keeps on gaining weight. So he speaks to his friend, and he says, "Do you have any suggestions for me?" And so the friend says, well, tell me how you start your day. Well, he says, "I'm so conscientious about trying to lose weight that I even walk to work. However, when I'm about a block away from my office, I smell the fresh baked goods in the corner bakery store, and I go unconscious until the next thing when I wake up. I'm walking out of the bakery with a little brown bag in my hand." And the friend says, "Well, you know, the solution is obvious. Leave your wallet at home." And the man who has a small desire for losing some weight looks at his friend and he says, "Are you telling me I should steal the donuts?" So obviously this man, he has a small desire to lose some weight, but he has a bigger attachment, a bigger desire for donuts, for sense gratification. And that wins the day.
Let's take that story, and you talked about sense gratification, and I think, you know, and that's one of the, as you call them, the three amigos of the four functions. Let's delve into the four functions so we can understand how conscience works with that. Now, my producer's telling me, since we're going to go deep and stay down long, that we need to take a brief break right now. So let's take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about the four functions of the mind.
Perfect.
Hi there. You're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and this is Charlie Hedges. My very, very special guest is Leonard Perlmutter, who, also known as Ram Lev, is a, you know, I'm really not sure how we describe Leonard, other than a very brilliant philosopher, spiritualist, and wise man. And he's written a book titled Your Conscience. And in the book, Your Conscience, he talks about the four functions of the mind. Now, we've already talked about one function, which I'm sure we may go over a bit more about the conscience, and that's the driving function or the deciding function of the mind. But there are three other functions. Leonard, do you want to go into those for us and help us understand what those are?
Sure. First is the ego. We're very familiar with ego, but we have a bit of a jaded understanding of what ego is. It's really not what Western psychology paints that picture of somebody who is just full of themselves. The ego is hardwired to the reptilian brain. That means that the ego, like the reptilian brain, is fearful about being annihilated. Basically, death of the form. And so both ego and the reptilian brain are all about self-preservation. That's why the ego goes around with a chainsaw all day long, all night long, and whenever it's in a relationship, it takes the chainsaw out and cuts the relationship in half and says, this is right here is pleasant. I say this is good. Let's reprise it. But this half over here is not pleasant. I consider it bad, and therefore it's to be avoided. So what the ego does is it sets up an attachment in our mind for both what we like and what we don't like. And so that gets to be a bit of a problem, because everything, after a while, is about what I want. But we already know that that which is pleasant isn't always good for us, and that which is unpleasant isn't always bad for us. What we really need is some kind of mental flexibility to know the difference. But you're not going to get that understanding from the ego, because the ego only has a very limited perspective. Sometimes it's appropriate. It's not always wrong. We need a healthy ego to have this kind of a conversation tonight.
Right.
We need a healthy ego to drive the automobile. But the ego is often wrong, but never in doubt. You know, the ego is a little bit like these talking heads on TV or on the news programs. They're often wrong, but never in doubt. They're so certain.
Yeah.
I mean, they're amazing people. They know everything about everything,
yes.
Even though so often they're wrong.
Yes, but not to themselves.
Right. So that's the ego. And again,
a question on the ego.
Go ahead.
The ego's fear is to be annihilated, according to what, and because it wants to exist, it wants to be the all-powerful essence of our being. I'm rather deeply steeped into the late medieval Christian mystics, and especially Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross, and they will talk about annihilation of the ego as a good thing, but I think they're using annihilation very differently than you are.
Correct.
I think they're talking more, as we had talked about, they're talking detachment from it, not allowing it to be the provocateur of what we do in our life. Would you talk to me about annihilation versus detachment from the ego, and why that's very healthy for us?
First of all, it's impossible to get rid of the ego or annihilate it or get rid of it. It's impossible, because any form that exists in the universe has an ego. I am the bubble. I am the bubble. I am the bubble. Or I am the rock. I am the rock. I am the human being. And so the ego identifies itself with what? With the appearance of the mind-body-sense complex. Not the reality, but the appearance. And so the ego thinks that I am the body and I am the mind. And if there is injury or quote-unquote death to the body, then ego becomes terribly, terribly fearful and angry that it's going to lose what it has. But the truth is that every form has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But all things, as George Harrison once sang about, all things must pass. So what does that mean? It means that birth and death are habits of the body. And even though I have a body, and I can use the body, and I have a relationship ongoing with the body, I am not the body. And so it's our job is to parent the ego, not to annihilate it, but to expand its panorama so that it can see that the ego really is everything. We call that G-O-D.
You know, I get silent because you're so profound that I find myself deep in thought every time you're talking. I really resonate with the idea of expanding. But at the same time, talk to me about, you know, within the expansion, there is a detachment that allows us to expand the ego in a proper way rather than in an unhelpful way, because we could expand the ego to be ever more powerful in its destructive state rather than expanding the ego in such a way that it serves us. Did I make any sense in that?
Absolutely. But you know, now we're going back to what we started with, and that's service. Our job is to be in service to the truth reflected by the conscience, even in our relationship with the ego. So the conscience, reflecting perfect wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind, is what is instructing us. Our job is to convince the ego, for the sake of an experiment, to trust that wisdom and experiment with it in ways that are not too taxing. So I say start with seemingly insignificant no-brainers. And we can talk about that, but let's finish with the four functions.
Yeah, let's move on to the five senses.
Yeah, so you have the senses. And we have sight and smell and taste and hearing and touch. So our mind projects our creative energy through the eyes and the nostrils, the mouth, the ears, and the hands and the feet, to go out into the material world to look and smell and taste and hear and touch and try to find objects and relationships that are going to make me happy, that are going to make me secure, that are going to make me healthy.
What kinds of objects, Leonard? Give me some examples of objects that I would use. Through the senses.
Food.
Food, sex. Yeah.
Right? Sleep. Even self-preservation. These are the four primitive fountains affecting all animals, including human beings. Food, sex, sleep, and self-preservation.
What about the visual of arts? Do the arts come into play there, or is that something different?
How do you define that?
Like... I'm enamored by the beauty of paintings or buildings and...
Well, that's the senses are not always wrong. Same as with the ego. So an aesthetic sense, like a beautiful painting, or a beautiful evening, or a beautiful relationship, is something that human beings need in this life. So in that case, I would say that the conscience is... As long as it's not an abusive relationship in any way, the conscience would give the good housekeeping seal of approval of that perspective.
But that's very helpful.
But generally speaking, the senses do not understand that every front has a back. They only go for the sizzle. This is advertising lingo now. You know, the advertising people, they like to sell the sizzle. You know, this is going to make you happy. This is going to make you healthy. This is going to make you rich. This is going to make you successful. But they never talk about the back end, the pain, right? That you really never get what you think that you're buying.
And that is the link to the ego, is it not?
It is related to the ego.
Because the ego is about pleasure and pain.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So the ego will interpret this pain.
That right. So the ego becomes the amigo of the senses. Hey, you know, we're together. Let's form an alliance. We're pretty strong together to control the city of life. And then you have the unconscious.
That's Talk to me about function. The unconscious.
This is everything that we deem essential to self-preservation. All these deep channels in the unconscious mind through which consciousness flows. That's why we think the same things, we say the same things, and we do the same things every day. They're like these major four-lane, five-lane highways. If you want to go from point A to point B, you don't necessarily want to take a town road. It'll take too long. You want to take the superhighway. And that's what consciousness does. It goes through the deepest, most unobstructed channel in the unconscious mind. And the unconscious mind, that which exists in the unconscious mind, is a million times more powerful than good intentions.
And what exists in the unconscious mind?
Say that again, please.
What exists in the unconscious mind?
Oh, our memories, our imagination, anything that we believe will bring about self-preservation.
Oh, so self-preservation is a key player in this whole argument. It's all.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I wouldn't say it's an argument.
Well, I mean, you know, in this whole discussion, I did, you know, yeah. I didn't mean argument like it's a debate. I meant in this whole position, this discussion.
Yeah, sure.
What that's about
That's the agenda. That's the agenda, because the ego senses and unconscious mind believe that they are the body and they are the mind.
And yet they don't want
that game to end.
Yeah, and we allow those to be the players, the decision-making players, the deciding factors in so many things that we choose to do and choose not to do, and yet you say there is a fourth function of the mind that unless we appropriate its abilities, we're going to just be making suboptimal choices.
That's right.
We appropriate the conscience.
That's right. That's right. And so our job in every relationship is to parent and train the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind to support the wisdom of the conscience. That's not so easy. That's why we have to start with seemingly insignificant no-brainers.
Yeah, you're talking, these are your experiments you were talking about, right?
Yes, this is, yes,
yeah,
the experiment.
Yeah, talk to me about, talk to me about
that. This is scientific.
Okay.
So here's what I do. If I have a relationship that I need to make a decision on what to be done, what's to be done and what's not to be done, I extend an invitation to the four functions of the mind, ego, senses, unconscious mind, and the conscience, to sit around the kitchen table for a conversation. And that's what we do. And so,
I mean, do you put pad and paper to that? I mean, physically, do you do that, or is it just something that
it's all mental?
It's all okay.
Pretty much all mental. But if people are visual, they can certainly write it down so that they can actually, in a concrete way, see it. Depends on how they best learn.
Right.
So, the question before the four functions of the mind is, we just finished dinner. Are we going to brush our teeth? Now, I will play the parent. So I'm sort of the coordinator of this conversation. So I say, ego, please tell the other functions of the mind what your perspective is on brushing our teeth right now after dinner. And what does the ego say? I feel that it's unpleasant, and I'm against it. I'm against change. So I vote no. Thank you very much, I say to the ego. I appreciate your limited perspective. And now I'd like to call on the senses. What do you say? Well, I know that we just finished dinner, but I would prefer to have another slice of apple pie, because the apple pie that we had for dessert tonight was really good, and I'm sure that the second slice might be even better.
Right.
So I vote no also. Okay, thank you very much, senses. And unconscious mind, what's your position? I'm with the other two. Generally, I'm with the other two. So I'm with the other two now. Thank you, unconscious. Now I'd like to ask all three of you, ego, senses, and unconscious mind, to just sit quietly, because I'm going to ask the conscience to reflect wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind and share what was discovered. And the conscience says, well, it would be a pleasure. So here's what the superconscious wisdom is telling us all. Number one, this human life is not a sprint. It is a marathon. In a marathon, such as life, we need strong, healthy teeth. We need strong, healthy gums. We need strong, healthy immune systems. And brushing our teeth, even though it's just a small act, has a very powerful consequence, a beneficial, healthy consequence. Because we eat so often, you know, we eat three meals, and even if we didn't brush our teeth every meal, if we brushed our teeth a couple of times a day, it would be very beneficial. So why don't we all go into the bathroom and brush our teeth and then come back and share what we experienced? And that's what happens. We all go into the bathroom, we brush the teeth for a couple of minutes, we come back to the kitchen table, and I ask the ego to start summarizing. What was your experience by brushing your teeth? And what does the ego say? You know, I thought it was going to be terrible. I thought I might die because of the change. But no, it wasn't so bad. It wasn't so bad. Good call. Okay, thank you. Senses, what do you say? Oh, I was very surprised, especially when the tongue was gliding over the teeth. And you know, I didn't feel that mossy feeling. Oh, I really don't like that mossy feeling on my teeth. And I don't have that. So I like that. I think it was a good result. Unconscious? What do you say? Well, it wasn't so bad. Wasn't so bad. Wasn't so bad. Okay. So what has happened? Just with a small experiment, the ego, the senses, and the unconscious mind begin to trust me as a fair regulator here, and they have also experienced a higher truth that they're not going to die simply by changing a habit and letting go of an old habit. They don't have to define themselves by that habit. They can create a new habit that will make them feel even better, like brushing your teeth. And once we build a little beachhead where they trust me and they're willing, with seemingly small, insignificant no-brainers to experiment with me and the conscience. Their perspective, the egos and the senses and the unconscious mind perspective, expands. And that's where the music starts.
I love it. If I may, let me try to put this in my language. And then you correct my language and tell me where I'm off or if I'm on. Is that each of us live in a world in which we have the odds stacked against us. And we have the odds of pleasure and pain, what feels good, immediate gratification. We have our history of experience, which we look at, you know, largely from the negative sort of standpoint, but not necessarily that. But then we also have, you know, the conscience, but let's just call her wisdom. And that we have this wisdom that we have an innate sense of wisdom that tells us that is always sharpening these other tools. It doesn't necessarily mean the ego and the senses and the unconscious is bad, but that they may be off kilter, and that wisdom, when applied, will truthfully turn around the decisions of the ego, the senses, and the unconscious. That they will take that pain that we perceived and move it more into the line of pleasure and more into the line of long-term good. Did I explain anything well there? Or
yes, you hit the nail on the head. That's exactly correct. I will just add one other factor that's very powerful that influences many choices, and that is because human beings are animals, we are subject to the herd instinct.
Oh.
And it's very powerful. And we know from watching those movies, those films, like National Geographic or something, of animals, like on the plains in Africa, when you have like a deer or a zebra that has a bad leg and winds up on the periphery of the herd, that's where the lion or whatever is going to look for dinner is going to go after one of those animals that is not protected by the herd. So human beings, too, want to tuck in to the center of the herd. Now, that can mean the culture, the general culture. It can be influences like religion or age or race or gender. So these forces want to conform us to the herd mentality.
For protection.
Yes. Yes.
And maybe protection from a false enemy.
Yes.
Because there may not be, you know, it's likely there are not lions out there. There are annoyances, but they're not going to kill us.
But also, if I step away from the herd's way of thinking about something, it's going to be taken as a criticism by the herd.
Oh, yes.
Are you considering us bad because we do this habitually? So it's seen as a criticism. So unless you have a good sense of humor, not to be swept away in a flood of anger over people's resentment of your going a different way to a different drummer for certain kinds of situations. Not all of them, because many times the culture or whatever the herd is provides wonderful gifts. I mean, we're so blessed in this culture by so much. And yet, not everything is a blessing. Some of it is a curse. So you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You pick and choose, not based on my will, but thy will.
Yeah, not based on the ego or the senses, based on something, a higher value.
So there's a marvelous phrase that's in a lot of gangster movies, which tickles me. And I use it with students a lot, and the phrase that's used in these gangster movies is something to the effect: nothing personal, strictly business.
Right.
Nothing personal, strictly business. And so when the herd is bent out of shape because in food choices, for example, I decide that I want to become a vegetarian because my conscience is telling me it'll be healthier for me, and I get pushback from the herd, I don't take it personally.
No.
Because for me, it's strictly business. I want to be happy. I want to be healthy. I want to be secure so that I can serve as best I can for whatever time I have here on the planet.
I love that, and I think that's a great way to wrap us up. That's a profound statement, and you know, I'm going to encourage the listeners, I'm going to put it in the show notes, to take a look at your book, Your Conscience. I'm pulling up the subtitle right now, Your Conscience, the Key to Unlock Limitless Wisdom and Creativity and Solve All of Life's Challenges. And the life's challenges are the ones that are brought on by what you call the three amigos, by the ego, the senses, and the unconscious, and how we can combat those with the stabilizing wisdom of the conscience. And this happens, which we could maybe get into in another podcast, but this happens through meditation, contemplative, you know, sometimes contemplative silence and solitude, because your experiments require an intentional thoughtfulness to this whole process, that we can no longer just act knee-jerk, that we must think about our responses, think about our actions, and evaluate them in light of conscience or wisdom and how that impacts our life. I think you know, your book brings that out, and I will have that in the show notes for people to get that. Is there any other way you would like people to get in touch with you?
Well, we have two websites. One is for the book, Charlie. It's yourconscience.org, yourconscience.org. And I teach through the American Meditation Institute, and that's where I offer classes. And I would invite people to take a look at our website, which is americanmeditation.org.
Okay, I will make sure those are in our show notes. And Leonard, I want to thank you for being on the show. I'm so intrigued by your deep and yet very practical wisdom. I think you have so much to offer us. You're a very special person. So thank you so much for being on the show with me.
Well, thank you, and I'm looking forward to continuing the relationship.
Likewise, and I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in to the next chapter with Charlie. And as usual, until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.